Next, the court will call the case of AMX Enterprises LLP versus Master Realty Corporation.
May it please the court, Michelle R. Brad R. for Appalachia.
All right, Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. We are here on a case that's primarily going to center, I think, on two major issues. One is whether interest can be told under the Prompt Payment Act by the trial court, and the second issue is whether AMX should be entitled to recover any of its attorney's fees, or alternatively, whether that issue needs to be remanded back to the trial court for consideration. Real briefly, the facts of this case relate to a remediation that was done by AMX on behalf of Master Realty from a flood that arose on a Ramada hotel back in 2001. AMX did the work, really no complaints. It sent its bills. Some were paid, some were not paid. In October of 2003, AMX filed suit. Subsequently, in 2004, Master Realty counterclaimed, alleging damages. The case proceeded to trial before the jury. All answers were favorable to AMX on all of its claims under breach of contract and the counterclaims. The attorney's fees issue was submitted to the court by motion practice. Post-verdict, the trial court entered judgment of damages of $46,000 to AMX, but it completely denied AMX 100% of its attorney's fees and also told interest under the Prompt Payment Act on the grounds that AMX was responsible for delaying the trial proceedings. So a little bit with that backdrop, I'd like to address what I think is a couple interesting issues for this court. One is whether the trial court has the authority to toll under the Prompt Payment Act. Both sides have briefed this pretty thoroughly. The first issue to look to under the Prompt Payment Act is there any language in there in the Act that allows the trial court to toll? And there is none. It's not disputed by either side. Cited sorts that the best authority is to ordinarily look at the truest manifestation of the legislature's intent is to look at the actual statute. Master Realty cites no cases saying that the trial court has any authority to toll under the Prompt Payment Act. At trial, Master Realty relied on two Court of Appeals cases out of San Antonio and Section 304.101 of the Finance Code. That statute only applied to wrongful death, personal injury, and property damages case. So even if the statute were to be looked to, it certainly didn't apply to this case. And secondly, that finance code provision was repealed prior to this lawsuit ever even being filed. So I think any reliance on a repealed finance code section about tolling prejudgment interest is not any authority for the trial court to rely on. It makes an argument of equitable tolling, which we've cited cases rejecting those. So that leads us to, at least AMX believes that the trial court didn't have any authority to toll for the alleged delay in the trial court matter. And there was quite a bit of briefing back and forth on the issue of what the Prompt Payment Act is. Is it prejudgment interest? That's really, I think, an argument further down the logical line, because I don't think there's just any tolling provision that applies. But if the court were to go further down the logical analysis and say, well, this is prejudgment interest and we disagree with your position about the repeal of the statute, or we think you can toll equitably, I think that's where this issue gets in under whether or not the Prompt Payment Act is interest or it's a penalty. There's quite a bit of briefing on that. I think there are certain things that I think are are accurate from both sides, is that the amount of the damages that are to be paid under the Prompt Payment Act are calculated based on a percentage, 1.5%. And in that respect, I think it is somewhat enticing to just look at it and say, oh, it's prejudgment interest. It's also, it's an interest amount based on an amount that's before a judgment. So when you look at it that way, you can say, sounds like kind of like prejudgment interest. But I think when you analyze it, and the cases that are cited in all 50 states have prompt payment acts, it is certainly an incentive, a penalty to a person whose owner has not paid the bills to quickly pay contractors. It's obviously an incentive under the legislature history that we cited to get payments made quickly. Many of the contractors out there are small businesses, and they don't have the ability to finance this type of activity. And so whatever way you want to look at it, I think the analysis is that it is certainly an incentive, a penalty to pay promptly, hence the name, to get that money out and paid. In contrast, prejudgment interest is for the loss of use of money, which could be anywhere in today's rates, 5, 6%, things of that nature. This clearly is at 18% per annum. It's a stick to get payment made. And alternatively, I guess the legislature could have said, we're just going to do a blanket penalty, right? We're going to pay you, you're going to pay $10,000 for each month you don't make a payment. Well, they can't do that because each project varies from small projects of $5,000 up to multi-million dollar projects. So the percentage analysis is flexible relating to the size of the claim, because obviously $10,000 penalty on a $5,000 claim would be horrendous. It'd be punitive. But $10,000 on a $20 million project would be no incentive whatsoever to have the owners pay out those funds. So in that respect, I think the legislature tied it to the interest, to the amount that's due and outstanding and payable. And I think under any of those guidelines, the trial court did not have authority to toll the statutory interest. And also those issues, the amount that was due was stipulated, when the bills were sent, when payment was made eventually, and things of that nature. So, and we went in pretty good detail, and opposing counsel went into some detail as well as to how that interest should be calculated. And we think the trial court just erred in that analysis and should have awarded that. Interestingly, on the $10,000 amount, there's a conclusion of law on that amount, but there's no corresponding finding of fact to support that, and just concludes that we weren't entitled to that segment of the $10,000 in interest under the Prompt Payment Act, but no real explanation as to why we weren't entitled to that. The second issue,
Mr. Michelle.
Yes,
I have a question. Do you think that there's any way that that a defendant could stop the accruing of the penalty during the pendency of litigation? In other words, do you think that a payment into the registry of the court, or do you think that that can happen, or do you think that once litigation is commenced, the defendant is on the hook for the penalty until a judgment's entered?
No, I think the defendant certainly could tender the payment to the plaintiff under a right of some type of reservation, but certainly under the Prompt Payment Act, if you're going to dispute it, and because you've got that penalty, I think the legislative scheme is set up to pay that, to cut off the penalty part of it, then you're going to go and fight about who was right or who was wrong under that analysis. Tendering it into the registry of the court to cut off the prejudgment interest, quite frankly, Your Honor, I don't think I've heard that argument raised at any point in the briefing, so it's an interesting question. My initial reaction would be no. I don't think you could tender it in there, but I would certainly like some thought on that analysis, since I don't think it was raised at any time really below or in the appellee's brief. With regard to the second issue is the attorney's fees issue. And we have an issue presented to the court I think the big overview is whether the court is going to look at the market approach, which was AMX's position, is prevailing rates, reasonable rate of attorney's fees, as you would testify in any attorney's fees case in which you're trying to recover them. AMX's attorney's fees were in part sought by in-house counsel. And so there's been much briefing both sides as to whether this court should follow the market approach or the cost approach. The cost approach being basically you take the attorney's salary, the expenses attributed to him, add those up and say it wasn't actually $300 an hour when you get all down to it. The amount of time he spent on this was some form of overhead that was attributable to the corporation. We have cited a number of cases in our brief. We also cited a number more in our reply brief. Certainly, it's AMX's position that the overwhelming weight of authority is the market approach. We also cited the court to the Tesoro opinion, which we believe supports our position. Many of the reasons that the courts, and they applied in many different situations, obviously the pro se lawyer, the indigent lawyer who never, indigent client who never paid any actual attorney's fees, government agencies who would possibly be that, trusts, things of that nature. And so we tried to give you as much a spectrum as we could on a variety of cases from across the country. Some of the rationale behind that is, one, it's predictable. It's easier to do. It's easier to administer. It has more objective standards, which can be applied uniformly. And they can be applied across the board in many different types of situations. In contrast, the courts have said the cost approach is cumbersome, intrusive, costly to apply, distorts incentives for settlement, and rewards inefficiency, and it's a burden and bad public policy, to summarize many of the cases that we've cited. There was a response in the appellee's brief that this somehow would violate the ethics about letting a corporation profit. The opinion was not attached, and I think it's an overstatement of saying they're just going to profit from these. These are actual representations by a company that is representing a claim. Those arguments have been made before, and we cited a case in our reply brief that rejected that argument that it's profiting by a corporation. If you take that approach, you could say any in-house lawyer who helped do a transactional deal and made millions and millions of dollars said, you know, he only spent $100,000 worth of the times that resulted in a $100 million merger and acquisition deal. They illegally profited under that analysis. I think it's an extremely broad brush. There's no cases supporting that. There's been no cite to that that contention at all. AMX submitted its attorney's fees in two parts, one by its in-house counsel and one by its local counsel. The trial court rejected both. I don't see how any analysis, even if the court were to assume that because the affidavits were submitted in the form of a market approach, that that would disqualify local counsel's attorney's fees. As local counsel's attorney's fees can see from Mr. Ed Cox, he performed many of the local duties here, helped try the cases, took different witnesses, things of that nature. The court uniformly just entered findings of facts that said, you know, they were, well, all of them were unreasonable. All of them were not necessary. And there was no controverting affidavit saying that they were unreasonable or not necessary. We've cited the Ragsdale case. When you've got uncontroverted evidence of attorney's fees, the court is obligated to render attorney's fees in that matter. By any stretch of the matter, I don't see how the court could strike, with the exception of if the trial court took the position that the market approach was just the wrong approach and you had to put on some evidence of the cost approach. Arguably, that could be some evidence, a basis of disallowing those because there was not a cost approach submitted. We've also asked the court, if that's the position this court's going to take, It would be a first opinion in the state of Texas, and we would ask on the attorney's fees issue for an interest of justice that that be remanded should the court take that analysis. But the second approach, it still doesn't explain the local counsel's denial of their attorney's fees wholesale. That was an outside contract attorney hired very close to trial as things started heating up. Finally, on the segregation issue, AMX filed some new additional pleadings that did not allow for the recovery of attorney's fees 7 days before trial. I think under a very strict reading, although it would be almost an infinitesimal amount, some of those claims, some of those attorney's fees would perhaps have to have been segregated out under the Tony Golo Supreme Court opinion. However, also under the Tony Golo Supreme Court opinion, since there was some evidence of attorney's fees, that would entitle AMX to a remand on that issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michelle. Mr. Rapp.
May it please the court, counsel. I would like to touch on briefly what Mr. Michelle just said, and that is that because there was some evidence of attorney's fees, that it should be remanded. And I think the court clearly found that there was no credible evidence of attorney's fees being incurred, there was no credible evidence that they were reasonable and necessary. So there is nothing to remand on that point.
But how could there be no attorney's fees incurred in a trial? I mean, wouldn't a reasonable finder of fact, wouldn't that, applying the city of Keller, wouldn't any reasonable finder of fact have to conclude that after a trial, a party represented by a lawyer had some attorney's fees incurred?
They could assume that, but without credible evidence establishing that, it's just a failure of proof. I mean, they could assume, well, with all this, yes, there must have been. Surely there was. There was a lawyer working on it. But they still have to prove that at trial. And they have to prove that fees were actually incurred. And that's where they failed. There was no credible evidence, the court found. The court found that the court found that there was no credible evidence, that Mr. Callis's affidavit testimony was not credible. And to address what Mr. Michelle just brought up, the opinion 531 from the Texas Committee on Professional Ethics, the idea there is that a non-lawyer, in all the cases he cited with the market approach, dealt with lawyers representing law firms or themselves. In no case in Texas is there evidence of a lawyer representing a company and getting their market fee, their market rate, because that would be a company profiting from representation, from the practice of law, and they can't do that. What you have to show, and I mean, this makes logical sense, that what you have to show is that, hey, we are a company, we had to incur these costs by having our in-house counsel take on this representation. In other words, because he is representing, he is pursuing this litigation, we had to hire somebody to fill in this spot and handle these everyday matters here that he would otherwise be handling. Therefore, we incurred this cost of doing this so that he could otherwise practice, handle this litigation. And there was no evidence of that. And they have to be able to show that we as a company incurred a cost by doing this. They can't just hire a team of lawyers who all they do is litigation and try and get attorney's fees. That would be a company, a non-lawyer, making fees off of its employees.
But, you know, this brings to mind for me Rule 12. I mean, it seems like this whole argument runs contra to Rule 12 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. In other words, you know, a corporation can't represent itself, and if a corporation tries to represent itself and appear pro se, then the parties will file a motion to show authority how the corporation can represent itself. And so it seems like this is bringing to a head a conflict, because it seems like you can't say, well, that lawyer works for the corporation, and so the corporation can't get fees, but then there was never a Rule 12 motion saying that the corporation's representing itself, so it should have to file outside counsel. Are you following me?
I'm following you, and I think that you bring up a very good point. The problem is Mr. Callis never revealed to us that he was in-house counsel. We couldn't discern that from any of the things he had filed. In the request for disclosure responses, there was no evidence that he was in-house counsel for the plaintiff. He put in there in-house counsel for a corporation. And in his earlier affidavits, he states in there that he has a billing rate of $200 an hour. And then in Mr. Cox's affidavit as well, Mr. Cox says that Mr. Callis's billable rate of $200 per hour. Well, he didn't have a billable rate of $200 per hour. He didn't have a billable rate. He was paid a salary. We presume. We don't know. And then when asked in deposition of their corporate representative, what's the relationship of Mr. Callis and how is he compensated, they responded. Mr. Callis objected and wouldn't allow the witness to respond. And so all along, there was nothing to clarify for Master Realty that Mr. Callis was, in fact, in-house counsel for the corporation and was representing it in that capacity.
Thank you.
On the excessiveness and unreasonableness, the trial court is the finder of fact in that regard. And the trial court did find that all of the fees alleged were unreasonable and unnecessary. And specifically, the 8 causes of action, I think Mr. Michel touched on the fact that those were added just 7 days prior to trial. And so an infinitesimal, I believe is the word he used, amount of time might have been spent on those. I don't think that's fair. I think that just because those claims weren't added until 7 days before trial in no way indicates the amount of time they spent preparing for them going up. I mean, in the deposition of Mr. Bennett of Master Realty, Mr. Cal spent almost the entire deposition dealing with fraud issues related to a peripheral matter with a guy named Roger Buford and on insurance issues related to how they received the payments, which is clearly collateral source doctrine material. And some of these are related to money had and received claims and fraud claims that were added later, but he certainly was aware of them and preparing for them leading up to that point. With respect to
the excessiveness argument, is that's a factual sufficiency issue, isn't it? I mean, there would be evidence of some attorney's fees, but that would be a remand question, right?
I don't think that it would be a remand question. I don't see how this court can remand it on the cost approach, as Mr. Michel was talking about, or on any basis, because there were no attorney's fees to be segregated. If a fact finder had found there were some attorney's fees, I mean, all the cases you look at dealing with the failure to segregate specifically, there were attorney's fees that were found by the jury. These were reasonable and necessary attorney's fees. Therefore, it goes to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals says, well, wait a minute, they didn't segregate them. You got to send these fees back and split them up and figure out which are recoverable and which are not. Well, in this case, there was no fees, so you can't remand it to segregate nothing. Now, I want to touch briefly on the escrow funds, which we hadn't, I don't believe Mr. Michel got to, but I feel confident he will. And the funds that Master Realty put into an escrow account were purely for the benefit of the title company. And these funds were put in there so that they could sell the property in the midst of this lawsuit that had been dragging on forever. At no time did Master Realty agree that those funds could be used to be a security for any judgment that might that AMX might receive. At no time did Master Realty agree that if AMX dismisses its lien claims, then Master Realty will allow this money to be used as to satisfy a judgment. This is Master Realty's money that it put into escrow solely to benefit the title company. And the court order ordered Composite to deposit $93,800, I believe is the figure, into the registry of the court. It didn't say deposit the funds that are currently at this bank or the escrow funds related here. In fact, the court struck language indicating that and just said, fine, composite, you want to put up money to get these lien claims done, you put up $93,000, put it into the register of the court, and with you doing that, we will dismiss all the lien claims against you. And AMX dismissed the lien claims against Master Realty. So there is no claims, lien claims against either entity, and AMX dismissed those, and composite put $93,000. Now it happened to be our money. But it doesn't change the fact that it's our money. The court recognizing that when it decided to pay composite's fees out of our money, it then left enough in the registry of the court to cover the amount of its judgment and then reimbursed Master Realty the difference. And our position would be that all of that was in error and that all of the money should have come right back to Master Realty, but it certainly should not go to AMX. Because it was our money, and it was never intended to cover any judgment. Now, my last issue is the interest issue, and I printed off a copy of the Texas Practice Guide, updated in June 2008, and it, while certainly not binding authority, notes that in following the concept that the prejudgment interest is an equitable aspect to the judgment, the trial court has discretion on whether to award prejudgment interest during periods of delay, even if they may be caused by the claimant. And it cites the Tegel versus Galvin case out of San Antonio and Aquila Southwest Pipeline versus Harmony, as well as Purcell versus Welch. And our position is that this is the current state of the law. And
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Isn't section 28.004 more specific than that section? In other words, as a rule of statutory construction, don't we have to apply the more specific statute?
Well, I think that it kind of brings us back to the whole the question of its interest. Michelle mentioned, is it penalty or is it interest? Well, no matter how you care to characterize it, it is clearly interest according to Chapter 28. And with it being interest, and it ends at a judgment. Therefore, it is prejudgment interest by definition. So then we have to look to, well, this is prejudgment interest. How are they entitled to it? Well, they're entitled to it by a specific statute that says they're entitled to it. But no matter, it is prejudgment interest. So is there any means by which we can toll it? So then you can look to equity. And I find it fascinating that AMX wants to have it both ways. They want, this is prejudgment interest. Why? Because then DeSoto and Ebbie Halliday apply, and there's no tolling, because those cases hold that there's no tolling of prejudgment interest. So it's prejudgment interest. But then on this hand, no, it's a penalty. It's a penalty. Why? Because we also get prejudgment interest on top of, not on top of the penalty, but we also get prejudgment interest. That's what they're asking this court to do, is to give them penalty interest under the statute and then also prejudgment interest.
But isn't there precedent for that, like in the Prompt Payment Act contained in the insurance code? Don't you get that penalty in addition to prejudgment interest?
There are several cases. Marino, I believe, was out of this court in which that is true. In that case, and contrary to the property code case, all the cases that deal with the interest code call it a penalty. The legislature knows how to use the word penalty. Cases know how to use the word penalty. There's no cases out there that talk about the Prompt Payment Act using the term penalty. It's not there. It's not a penalty. Whether
So you would distinguish 28.004 from the provision of the Prompt Payment Act in the insurance code because of that language?
I would. And then also I would direct the court to the Allison court, or to the Allison case, which is out of Austin in 2002. And that was a insurance claim brought under 21.55. And in that case, the court did say that, yes, this is a penalty, but we're going to toll the period, the limitations, or toll the prejudgment interest, the penalty interest, because of delays caused by the claimant.
And that was under which statute?
That was under Article 21.55 of the Insurance Code. So in that case, the court, that court found it to be a penalty. Now, in this court, in 2003, under Bledsoe versus Kuczek, I believe is how you pronounce it, K-U-C-Z-E-K, supported tolling of prejudgment interest for delays. And I would argue that that is the current state of the law under this court, is you can equitably toll prejudgment interest based upon delay, trial delays caused by a claimant. And I believe it's an abuse of discretion standard. The court found that there were trial delays. And I want to make sure the court is aware that I noticed last night that there was a verified motion that had not been included in the record, and I'm not sure if the court has been provided with a copy of that, but I requested a supplemental record be prepared, and I believe Sandy was going to get that to you, but that will be forthcoming, which lays out delays. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rapp. Mr. Michelle, you've got 5 minutes.
Justice Walker, responding to your question about depositing funds into the registry of the court, I think your question may be a bigger question than presented in this case here today for a couple of reasons. Number one, you heard Mr. Rapp just respond in his argument that any of the funds he deposited into the registry of the court were not meant to pay AMX. Secondly, the sole basis for tolling the attorney's fees, tolling the prejudgment penalty under the Prompt Payment Act was the delay in the AMX's fault in delay of the trial. There was never an argument ever presented that they had tendered funds into the registry of the court to toll the application of the Prompt Payment Act. Mr. Rapp cited the case of Allison. That case really has no application to the case at hand. That case dealt with where the party actually tendered the funds before litigation and the opposing party refused to accept them. It was all pre-litigation conduct. So in that situation, the tolling was not the, it wasn't a tolling, it was a tender of funds. And what the law of tender applies, whether you tender funds and if you wrongfully reject the tender of funds. So that's has nothing to do, this was all pre-litigation and had to do with tendering. With regard to in-house counsel and Rule 12, Mr. Rapp references, I believe, information that's outside the appellate record. Now, I was guilty of that because I responded as well because I didn't have, neither one of the information was inside the record. But my understanding was the objection was, since it's not before the court, the objection as to the issue of Mr. Callis's, the trial, AMX's trial counsel's attorney's fees, was basically, it was outside the scope of the corporate designation. And when you designate an attorney, and when you designate a corporate representative, the notice of deposition has the calls of which that corporate representative is designated to testify, and that was outside the call of the test of the what the representative was retained to do. With regard to that one last point I was going to respond to, and I can't recall, was if the court were to get to the delay issue, which I think is once again way down the logic, I think the court has many legal hurdles to get to before they ever get to the discretionary. But I would agree with Mr. Rapp at that point. If the court were to go down that logical trail that the trial court did have the authority at some point to toll those arguments, then it would be a discretionary decision. And took a large part of that reply brief. I hated to do it, but it's a really hard burden to come up and show that the trial court abused its discretion. I think we certainly put forward a lot of evidence that a lot of this was AMX pursued fairly quickly, filed suit, moved for summary judgment very quickly, had a transfer from Judge Womack to Judge Wade, causing delays, multiple continuances on the motion for summary judgment. Then a year later, a counterclaim that was clearly unmeritorious, rejected by the jury wholesale. Master Realty was simply using those funds as leverage, thinking they could negotiate, we'll get a lesser amount, we'll play hardball with you. AMX said, pay us our money. We did the work. I mean, we spent a good amount of time on the opening briefs because I thought it was important, showing how clear-cut all this work was done. All the reviews said the work was done wonderful, particle-free, hard, good, excellent work. The jury went with us wholesale on that. And then not to get our prejudgment, I mean, our prompt payment under the act, under alleged delay. I think there may have been a little personality conflict with trial counsel, but I don't think that's a ground to deny attorney's fees and a ground to toll the prejudgment interest. We'd ask the court to render on the prompt payment amounts due, render our attorney's fees, and the alternative, remand the issue on the attorney's fees to the trial court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Michel. Mr. Rapp, we appreciate your good arguments, and you'll be hearing from us. Thank you. You're dismissed.